My next guest this Saturday morning is Pulitzer Prize winner Elizabeth Colbert. She writes for The New Yorker and is the author of several books, including The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, which chronicled previous mass extinction events and compared them to the accelerated, widespread extinctions of our present time. Her latest book, though, is an alphabetical manifesto of climate change, a collection of 26 animated essays. It is called H is for Hope. And she joins us now. Kia ora, good morning. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What was the idea of approaching this book about climate change in this way?
Well, I think climate change can really seem quite overwhelming. It's not one story. It's many different stories. It's a scientific story, a technological story, a political, domestic political story, international political story. And my hope was to use the format of a alphabet book to break it, sort of break it down and then put it back together again.
It kind of subverts the format, really, because, of course, you think of alphabet books or flashcards for children as being sort of generally rather, you know, nice, comforting, heartwarming things. And this book is not one of those.
Well, it's definitely, playing with the form of a children's book, of an ABC book, in some sense, lightheartedly, in some sense, you know, very, very seriously.
Mm. How did you decide on how to assign the letters?
Well, as I suppose most people who write ABC books, I don't really know. You know, you begin with A, and A was actually quite easy in this case, because the first person to develop what we would sort of call a very rudimentary climate model back in the late 19th century was a Swede named Svante Arrhenius. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, his name begins with A, so that was very easy. But B already raised problems, until I remembered Greta Thunberg's famous speech, which she delivered in 2021, which, you know, really went viral, in which she, the sort of reprise was blah, 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 that everyone has just been talking, blah, 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 and not doing. And that sort of became B, and it sort of unfolded from there.
Your C then is capitalism. And by the time you get to D, it's despair. But despair is very short.
Yes, I mean, the idea was to sort of try to run through a lot of the, you know, sort of key points that people reach a dead end in a way, despair early on, and move on from that. Say, well, we can't just, you know, wallow in despair. We have to move on and look at things differently.
I've seen that you say that climate change resists narrative. Why do you say that?
Well, narrative, usually we require, you know, protagonists with agency. And the climate is really, you know, it's ubiquitous on some level. It's everything, but you wouldn't really say it has agency. And even though there are, you know, certain class of villains, you could say, in the climate narrative, you know, certainly people who have worked to try to resist, suppress public understanding of the issue, resist action on the issue. You know, the fossil fuel industry has been very rightly, in my mind, you know, criticized for its role in this, but it's not exactly an agent. It's not a villain like, you know, Dr. No from James Bond.
But indeed, you talk about the overwhelm and the fear that goes with climate change. And that reckoning around it, how do we begin to grapple with that, to really see it in a clear-sighted way, but then actually do more than nothing?
Well, that's sort of the, you know, we used to have in the U.S. a show, the $64,000 question. That's the $64 trillion question. How are we going to get our minds around this, both in a honest way and also in a way that gets inspires the kind of action that we need, which is, absolutely massive changes to our energy systems in particular. And, no one on some level has answered that question, because here we are, and globally at least, carbon emissions are continuing to rise. So, the hope, obviously, with the book is to give people the kinds of information and tools both to understand what's at stake and also to understand what is possible.
Yeah, you talk about hope, and of course, your H is hope and is the name of the book. Why did you want to go with that?
Well, if you write an alphabet book, naming it after letters sort of makes sense. And I, on some level, you could just say, I like the sound. H is for hope. It's also an allusion, I guess, to a lovely book by Helen MacDonald called H is for Hawk. And also, and people have reminded me, Sue Grafton, who is an American mystery writer who always wrote alphabetical mysteries, H is also for a homicide. So I think there's, she wrote a book called H is for a Homicide. So I think there's a lot of sort of layers in it.
Yes, it made me think Dial M for Murder, which,
Yeah,
I guess
exactly.
is not as nice a thing as hope for sure.
But it's a catchy title, yeah.
It certainly is. You had some pretty interesting experiences as you were going through researching the book. You did some interesting things. You saw some interesting things. If we can talk a little bit about temperature. And the essay that you have for that obviously is the T. It was a way, I suppose, perhaps of bringing the abstract into reality. Tell us about what you did for T for temperature.
Sure. I went to a lab in Texas, Dallas, Texas, where they are doing experimental work on the body's ability to withstand high temperatures. And what they do is they s gather volunteers who are willing to spend hours in this sort of, metal room where they just pump up the temperature and pump up the humidity. And the idea is you're wired to all of these devices that measure, mainly we're interested in your heart rate and your circulation, and to try to see what the human body can actually withstand, and when it starts to fail, how is it failing? I mean, I don't think they want to push, people into really dangerous situations. You're very carefully monitored, but that's the sort of basic idea. And heat is very dangerous because your body has to work very hard to pump blood to the surface to try to dissipate heat and try to keep your organs at the core temperature that they can function at. And especially for older people, that becomes very dangerous. If you have a very severe heat wave, you get a lot of deaths from just basically people's hearts can't keep up, and those tend to be among older people. And also, what can happen actually is that your gut can stop functioning, and you get this sort of leakage of bacteria from your guts. You can die of what's basically sepsis. And one of the things that comes through in all this work is how many people around the world are already subject to temperatures that are very dangerous. And as temperatures continue to rise, that is going to just increase, and it's particularly parts of the world where. So I had myself locked into this room. I went through this experiment, and I actually experienced it, and it was, very sobering. You have a hard time thinking when it's so hot.
And the temperature that you were at, I think, was at certainly over 40 Celsius, which is, I guess, the scale that we use here, but over 100 in Fahrenheit terms. But also the humidity that you experience, because, dry heat and wet heat, if you like, are two quite different things in terms of physiologically how the body responds.
Yes, and there's also a saying, I don't know if it's one that you use, but it's not the heat, it's the humidity, and that is true to a certain extent. One of the reasons that humid heat is so dangerous is because you sweat, when you sweat and that sweat evaporates, that's how you get rid of heat. And if it's so humid that you're that evaporation, there's no difference between the sort of water content of your body, the water content of the air, as it were, that impedes that evaporation process. And that also means that you're not dissipating that heat. And that can be very, very dangerous. And there are parts of the world that are very hot and very humid are going to get hit very hard.
You also ended up taking away a cinder block from a company in Canada. Tell us about your green concrete.
Yeah, that was a fun experience. I still have my cinder block. There are a lot of we all are, people are sort of probably familiar with what, that we need to move away from fossil fuels because that's such a huge part of our carbon emissions. But there are also other sectors of the economy that also are responsible for a lot of carbon in the atmosphere, and one of those is producing concrete. And concrete is a hard, what would be called a hard to decarbonize sector, because when you make concrete, one of the things you do is you heat up limestone, and that releases CO2. So it's sort of built, baked into this process. So people are looking for creative new ways to make concrete. And the folks that I went to visit up near Montreal are making concrete, or a concrete-like substance, I should say. They call it carbicrete, out of slag. Slag, mining slag. And when they're done, this concrete actually absorbs CO2. It doesn't give off CO2, it absorbs CO2. So that is quite an interesting development.
Indeed, it is. I guess also the option to electrify everything, including things like flight. And what are the places, I suppose, that you see hope in that particular sector and the possibilities there?
Well, certainly, electrifying a lot of processes, we certainly are seeing inroads on that. Electric cars were extremely rare. Now in the US, they're pretty common, and there are many parts of the world where they're much more common than in the US. So we can know that we can electrify a lot of the transportation sector. We also know that we can electrify a lot of our heating systems, which have traditionally, run on fossil fuels. So, there are many sectors that we already know how to electrify. It's simply a matter of doing it. And then there are some sectors that do become harder to, but once again, there are lots of really smart people in, material sciences and in working on these processes, and pretty amazing strides are being made there too.
And so, looking at this overall, one of the things that struck me about the book was how beautiful it was. It is an alphabet book format and it is illustrated. How did you work through the illustrations and the types of illustrations? What was that process like?
Well, the book is, I thank you for pointing that out. It's very beautifully illustrated by an artist named Wesley Osbrook. And Wesley and I had, and the editors of the book had many conversations. And I was looking once again to sort of play a little bit with the, antiquarian nature of an ABC book and the futuristic element of a book about climate change. And a lot of it is about new technologies. And so, we opted for a style that I think is reminiscent of sort of Victorian ABC books, but the subject matter of the illustrations is often, high tech. So that's also trying to sort of play those genres against each other.
And they're pretty stark, some of those illustrations at the same time. And for you, as you were going through this process, what were some of the most confronting things that you learned?
Well, I think one of the, really sobering and, dismaying parts of the climate crisis, obviously, is that so many, many people who did so little to contribute to it are, really on the front lines of it already. And the incredible, sort of callousness, I guess you would say, of the developed world toward this problem that has been created to a very large extent by the developed world and toward the developing world, and their sort of broken promises along the way. That researching that part of the book was, very disheartening.
One of the things that I found astonishing in some ways reading it was in your R for Republicans. Only 1% of Republicans said climate change was an important thing. No, I'm saying this wrong. Excuse me. Among registered Republicans, the figure was 0%. That's of people who felt climate change was the most important problem facing the nation. None.
Well, I don't know what it is, like in New Zealand, which is I've been to. I had a wonderful time when I visited New Zealand. But I in the US, the politics around climate change, as I should say, the politics around everything, I don't think this will surprise your listeners, is are very polarized, so that, people are kind of petrified to be those who are concerned about climate change, which should be everyone, but is only half the population, I suppose, about this upcoming election, because there are still many. It's still kind of the orthodoxy in the Republican Party to say, oh, either this isn't a problem or there's nothing that we can do about it, but some kind of inaction is always the response. And we have absolutely, I can't say this strongly enough, run out of time for an action.
And so, with that context, is climate change likely to be a significant issue in the next election?
Well, I sadly think it probably won't be, and that will be because, on the one side, because of, and I don't want to get into too much into the nitty-gritty of electoral politics in the US, but that has to do in part with these few swing states that will swing the election in November, and the politics around energy and around energy extraction. And the US is pretty much the biggest energy producer, fossil fuel energy producer in the world at this point. So there are a lot of jobs at stake. So I think even though Joe Biden has done a lot of things that are commendable, I don't think he wants to go there because of the potential of alienating, a thin slice of the electorate in these very close states. And Donald Trump will certainly not make an issue of it, except to sort of make fun of electric cars or say that they're coming after your, barbecue or something like that. So there will be, this sort of conspiracy of silence around the issue, I fear.
We need to look beyond just the environment, though, and the environmental damage being done. That is something that comes through loud and clear in the book as well. It is about action. It is about xenophobia. It is about where people may end up living. For many people, it is hard to visualize what another life looks like. How do we address that uncertainty?
Well, I think that is also a very key point that you're making, that one of the we're very stuck in our ways, and a lot of the effort is around just sort of, what can we do to substitute out one form of energy for another, so that we can just keep on doing what we're doing and not really fundamentally change anything, because people are not keen on change, and it's really not clear that can get us where we need to go. And already you see around the world, huge political and humanitarian problems around refugees and immigrants. And when you just think about it, and this will be a big, issue in places like, island nations in the South Pacific, As sea levels rise, as there's saltwater intrusion in places that now are important, farming areas, as some places become simply too dry to farm, or flooding, which also you can have, cycles of severe drought and then cycles of flooding. We just saw that incredible flooding. I'm sure your listeners saw pictures of that incredible flooding in the Middle East recently. That is, very clearly has the fingerprints of climate change on it. You're going to see millions and millions of people on the move, and probably millions of people already are on the move going to climate change. It can be hard sometimes to disentangle the causes, and that will have hugely destabilizing effects. And we've seen sort of the political repercussions of some of that already, and they're not very pretty.
If despair is not an option, and in this book it isn't, what is the way to galvanize people to actually make change and make a reality out of this?
Well, I think the message that I hope the book delivers is, this problem is coming at us. It's not going away. It's not going to magically go away. And we are going to have to deal with it. And we can try to deal with it. We can try to make it, ameliorate it, mitigation. We can try to reduce the scale of the crisis, although we are already, it's already pretty big. I don't want to minimize that. And we can try to react intelligently to the consequences, or we cannot, and then we will all just bear the consequences in different ways. But there's no sort of avoiding it. So the obvious intelligent response, if we were truly, Homo sapiens, truly an intelligent species, would be to roll up our sleeves and try to do the best we possibly can at this moment.
Because the outcome isn't necessarily baked in, and we will not know the outcome, I shouldn't imagine, within our lifetimes, right? So,
Well, this is a
looking.
very, very, yeah, no, go ahead.
No, on you go.
This is a very, very long-term problem. It's not going away, in your or my lifetimes. It's not going away in our kids' lifetimes. It's not going away in our kids' kids' lifetimes. I think that's another thing people need to appreciate. It's not like many pollution problems where once you sort of stop adding to the problem, it starts getting better. That carbon that we've put up in the air is going to be there, for all intents and purposes, forever, certainly for centuries. And it's going to be warming the earth for centuries. And even after we stop putting carbon up there, which Lord knows should be as soon as possible, we're not getting back the climate that we had. We're just not making things worse anymore.
You talk about humans being intelligent. Do you ever wonder about that when you
Oh,
work in this
yeah.
field?
Daily, yeah.
Because that's the key, right? Is that the indicator of true intelligence that we would be able to stop and to deal with this before, the sea is literally lapping through our homes?
Yeah, I mean, there was a famous quote, or a quote that I've always been fond of, from a guy named Sherry Rowland, who is one of the scientists who discovered ozone depleting chemicals and really played a crucial role in getting those chemicals phased out, and is certainly really important for Southern Hemisphere countries like New Zealand, that we'd stop producing the chemicals that were depleting, creating the ozone hole over Antarctica. And he said once, "What is the use of having these predictive sciences if we just sit there and wait for them to come true?" So that is exactly what has happened here. The first the science of climate change has been understood, really honestly since Arrhenius's time in the 1890s, and certainly since the 1960s. And you go back and you read the warnings from the 60s, and they could have been written, yesterday, but we just sat there and have just let everything, come true.
Thank you very much for joining us on Saturday morning. That is Elizabeth Colbert there, Pulitzer Prize winner, and her latest book, a really beautiful alphabet book on climate change. H is for Hope is the title. It's definitely worth taking a look at that one.